Surveyor was the lead in for Apollo, and somewhere along the line, when the Apollo organization at Honeysuckle was up and running, it was necessary to have the wing at Tidbinbilla, and that building construction was done. I'm guessing it was somewhere in 1967, and the equipment arrived. An organization was set up with technicians for the wing side, and an operations organization was set up. Now, one of the guys that I mentioned at Woomera, who was sort of my shift supervisor in the days when we were a mixed weapons research people and contractors, was Tony Keeler. Now, Tony, as I think I mentioned, had been in the RAAF in Korea in some technical form. He came across to Tidbinbilla at around this time. He was good mates with Don Gray because of the Air Force contact, and Tony was integrated into the operational group. We then had this wing operational group formed, and Tony and I were the op supervisors for the wing. Tony saw himself as the more senior of the two. He was older than I was. Mm-hmm. And anyway, operationally, the plan was that we would split the 24 hours during Apollo missions. In the lull time in between Apollo missions, we could be used as op supervisors in the deep space side of things. But it didn't always happen because there were always training schedules that, you know, we were just essentially full-time ops people on the Apollo side for the few years of the Apollo program.
Did most of the people in the wing come from the deep space part of the station, or did they come in from outside?
Some of them came from Woomera, and some of them came from outside. I wasn't across the recruiting side of it. I don't know.
But while all this was happening, the deep space main part of TID was still continuing.
Yeah. There was equipment installations, of course. Dave Scaff from JPL, his first contact that I had with him was in 1966 when he came out to install the MSFN DSN switch on the microwave stuff, and that was to essentially switch all of the front end to either to the wing for manned space purposes or to the DSN control room for deep space stuff. Mm-hmm. And that equipment installation went on along with the specific manned spaceflight equipment which arrived. There was sort of rivalry, technical rivalry, if you like, in that we at Tidbinbilla had a MASER, which was a lower noise amplifier than the power amp that Honeysuckle had. And we used to always think that we outperformed them on weak signals, and we probably did. But yeah, there used to be operational rivalries about who could acquire first the spacecraft signal. Yeah, naturally, between, and it's good for team morale to develop rivalries to a degree. So yeah, that sort of thing went on. Anyway, Apollo 7 sort of came out of the blue to us at Tidbinbilla. We didn't expect to be called up. Tony Keeler had been sent to Houston for familiarisation and to get to know the people and the ops side of things, just at the time when Apollo 7 decides that they're going to need the wing side as well. So that was a bolt out of the blue. I don't know about to Honeysuckle, but it was a bolt out of the blue to us at Tidbinbilla, because all of a sudden I'm the only ops person to cover the 24 hours a day sort of business.
Yeah.
And
being orbital, it is going all the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a whole lot of hocus-pocus that went on with the countdown before you tracked. There were all these readiness tests, and it was all a bit of magic to some of the guys that came across from the DSIF side of things to get to know all of this. I know that I had to brief them on how to use the intercom before we were, it was just a very, very late commitment we got, and it was on-the-job training.
Mm.
I was telling them how to use the intercom, what the nets were for, who was at Honeysuckle and what they were called and on the net. And, oh, it was it was a scramble. Anyway, on launch day, I think that I worked a 17-hour day that day for launch and the first pass, and then, well, it might have been a couple of passes, I don't know. But when our commitment was over and we'd done the post-tracking tests, we went home, and I was home for 3 hours, and then the phone rang. Oh, they want you back at work. Oh, boy. So 3 hours sleep, I went back there, and Houston didn't realise that we had a mountainous horizon mask, and all of their tracking prediction was based on an absolute flat horizon.
Gee.
And, you know, they'd called us up about 6 hours ahead of what was necessary for the first pass, and that caused a lot of angst. But anyway, we got through Apollo 7 okay as a wing site, and Honeysuckle performed pretty well. You know, you can talk to Mike Den about that, but by then I think that he had gone to Honeysuckle, yeah. So that was Apollo 7. That was the first shakedown, if you like, and they proved that, we can stand the rigours of whatever the network might want to throw at us. And so then when Apollo 8 went around Christmas time of 1968, we had an absolute marvellous mission, and it was just brilliant to be part of it.
And you had long track periods too, didn't you?
Yeah. I guess because of the attitude of the Earth, Moon or something or other, we had rather long tracks, and naturally because of our low noise receiver threshold, they used a lot of our telemetry data.
So your data went via the microwave over to Honeysuckle?
Microwave to Honeysuckle, yeah. After that, in appreciation, we all got invited to the embassy for a garden party. You've copies of invites for that, I'm sure.
Yes.
9 was the Earth orbit checkout of the LEM. Again, that was pretty demanding, being an Earth orbit type mission.
Did the Tidbinbilla antenna have trouble keeping up in Earth orbit? Yeah.
No, we could hack it. Okay, you know, I used to make the antenna engineer worry, I suppose. But so that was 9. 10, the first moon orbit, and that again was brilliant. And then, of course, 11, which was just perfect again. The story of the transmitter fire at Tidbinbilla is well known, well documented.
So that was in the power supply, was it?
Yeah. It was just one of the cabinets. I think it was a power supply cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
It was one that was down in the building, which was the utility building between the ops room and the antenna. So, Alan Blake worked all night on that, cleaning up all the charcoal, smoke and whatever. And, of course, that meant that we wouldn't be favoured for covering the lunar module.
That's a shame.
Yeah, that's all history. And so, we did a marvellous Apollo 11 mission. What wasn't that well known was that around about that time there was an influenza epidemic. Brian Eagledon came onto our shift with the flu, and within 3 days the whole shift had the flu. And we had to track through being really, really sick. I can remember Bob Cudmore coming around saying, "Oh, can I give you a shot of scotch to get you through?" I said, "No, that'd kill me." Bob Cudmore was the chief engineer at the time.
Goldstone had been hit with the same flu during Apollo 8.
Yeah.
So then came down the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah. So anyway, I was so sick after Apollo 11, I didn't go to any of the post-mission celebrations or anything. It really knocked me. And then, of course, Apollo 12, they decided that a team from Tidmanbilla should go up and staff Parkes. Well, I was selected for that as the ops chief. The team leader was a guy called Roy Stewart, who was a computer engineer on the DSN side of things, and Jack Dickinson was the receiver RF senior technician, and Peter O'Donoghue was looking after a data, Harry Westwood the recorders, and I was doing the ops. And we had a pretty good mission for that, in that television didn't happen because, I don't know, I always say, it looked to me like the astronaut pointed at the sun, but I don't know the analysis.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, it looked to me like that's what happened because I was watching the TV of the downlink, and boom. Anyway, we had a pretty comfortable mission at Parkes.
You would have been
based in town at a motel. We used to just drive out for the sort of 16-hour stint. We ate meals, I think, in the CSIRO canteen down about a mile away where they used to house their astronomers.
Oh, yes.
Anyway, that was 12. 13, you've heard a lot about that.
So you were at TID when you started?
On shift. The mission plan was getting adventurous. They wanted to do experiments with the instrumentation unit, which was a part of the launch rocket. They had this plan. They were going to do tests with the IU, and they were going to do RF experiments, and that meant powering it up. And it powered up, of course, the plan always was that it was on the lunar module frequency. And John Mitchell is a good one to talk to about this, but when the service module went bang, they then decided to use the LEM as the lifeboat. They had to power up the LEM. That meant these two downlinks were almost on the same frequency. And it was a real bother. And John Mitchell advised the ops team to pull the IU off to one side and pull the LEM off to the other side. And that was the right tactic to do.
Mm-hmm.
But in that process, Houston required to get, you know, a big dish up, and they wanted Parkes.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tom Reed may have talked to you about the negotiations that went on with the CSIRO. But all that happened that I knew of was that, look, we're going to have to get Parkes up. You guys that went up there last time, I want you to fly up there, just I think he put it through the chief engineer, Bob Cudmore. But, you know, we have to get up there pronto. I can remember, I think I went home and I got some clothes. I must have, but I didn't have time to change much. We had to be out at Canberra Airport, you know, in the space of an hour or something or other, hour and a half, because it used to take an hour to get into town. But I know that that I turned up at Parks with Jack Dickinson. I really am scratching to think who the data operator was. And looking at the photograph, I still can't say who it is.
And Harry Westwood was there too, wasn't he?
Harry Westwood was on the recorders, yep. But there was a data DMOD guy. And I really can't say 100% that's either Peter Stewart or Ted Wilcox.
Uh-huh.
I can't pick who it was, and I can't remember looking at the pictures. But anyway, when I look at the picture that John Sarkisian has sent of me at Parks, we've just got there. We're trying to work out predictions, trying to work out frequencies. I'm still in my suit and whatever, because I used to go to work in a suit for Apollo. I used to go to work in a suit for every mission as an ops supervisor. My suit coat is folded over the top of the DSN type intercom, the TIC as it was called, and I'm leaning over that trying to work out predictions. I know that was what was going on. So it was a real scramble. Anyhow, I do remember there was something or other that we had which we couldn't get out. I can remember saying, I've got the bloody thing in my hand, but we can't get it to him. I don't know whether it was voice or data.
Right, yeah.
Now,
when you flew up, did you fly to Parks Airstrip?
Yeah, we flew to Parks Airstrip, from what I recall.
And just drove up.
It was dark. Yeah. We landed in darkness. And we, as I told Hamish, we're in this little plane that had a prop in the front and a prop at the back.
So you were in there and...
We were in there. John Bolton had got all of the Apollo front end installed for us. Had some... They were trying to get predictions. You know, when you're pointing a dish that's got a beam width of 0.1 of a degree, you've got to be right on it or you've missed it completely. And so John had done an excellent job. They were ready for us. We acquired the lunar module pretty soon. And as I say, I don't know what it was that I had, but I had a cable in my hand and I said, we've got the bloody stuff here. We can't get them to it. Get it to them. So,
and that was the first day or so, I guess, was it? You were getting telemetry and voice.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, perhaps, I don't know, a couple of hours worth of data that we gave them before, you know, it might have been 4 hours, I don't recall, of data that we got them before, you know, the spacecraft set. And then we had to organise ourselves down for sleeping accommodation down in the astronomers' emergency area.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to get ourselves up in time for the expected pass next day. And I was like an SB3, I suppose you'd say, you know, the USB supervisor at Parks.
Yeah.
And I was intercomming to John Saxon as the ops one position. And I had to do the teletype information in and out. And so, yeah, I was an ops supervisor there and the interface with the CSIRO.
And the Parks guys, they were driving the dish? What, Fox
they
Mason or somebody?
The dish.
Do you remember who was doing that? Or?
I don't. The structure of the pedestal meant that you couldn't always see.
They were on the other side.
Yeah. And you never really got a chance to get off your own position because it was full on. Yeah. So I did take a photograph of the team for Apollo 12, but when I took it, of course, I didn't put myself in it because I was taking the photograph.
Yes.
So I didn't get one of Apollo 13, unfortunately.
Mm. Nobody got any pictures of Apollo 13 that I can tell. Everybody was too busy.
Oh, it was just, it was just full on. Really great to look back on, but when, of course, you see the film of the dish, you've just got to discount everything factual. Yeah, so, you know, that was 13, a great success for mankind, I guess.
I was just reading in the technical report from Apollo 13 that because of Parkes, they're able to get about 20% more data back on the spacecraft. So
yeah, well, they were able to up the data rates, which is exactly what that report is saying. And we were very proud of our achievement, and the CSIRO should equally be very proud of their achievement on that, because, as I said, just pointing the dish at the spacecraft is a mammoth thing. Yeah, so that was Apollo 13. Apollo 14, I was back at Tidbinbilla, and I didn't recall us actually staffing Parkes, but it seems that Keith Aldworth and a few others were up there. I wasn't aware of that. 15, again, went pretty routinely. By that time, the big 64-meter antenna, as it was in those days, was being built, and I was seconded off to go and spend 6 months in JPL as part of the integration of all of the electronics for the DSN, station electronics, into the dish. And I didn't do Apollo 16. But when I came back and we had just about done most of the installation, I kept saying, we want to have this up for Apollo 17. That's going to be our unofficial objective.
Mm.
And as you know, we did track Apollo 17 using the 64-meter antenna,
yeah,
which was pretty cool. Yeah. So after that, operations at Tidbinbilla became very, very routinized. It was just constant shifts. So I went back to the DSN side of things. It just became a sausage factory of tracking schedules.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not the same when you're not tracking manned spacecraft, I guess,
yeah.
And you're not having encounters with things.
Yeah. There were exciting times with planetary encounters, but it had lost all of the really great excitement of Surveyor and then Apollo.
Yeah. How long did you stay at TID? I wasn't quite sure.
I stayed at Tidbinbilla until 1975, and I just couldn't take the continual shift work and having a young family. And my wife was struggling to keep the kids quiet while I was trying to sleep, and the stresses on the family, my family, I found were too great. So I just decided I'd get a regular 9-to-5 job type description, and I left Tidbinbilla and I went to the Australian Patent Office as a patent examiner.
Would have been different.
Yeah. Oh, I just took me 18 months to adjust to going at the pace of the public service. that is where I joined the public service, 1975. I stayed with the public service, and I changed departments to get a transfer back to Brisbane, my hometown. I joined Veterans Affairs. I was a methods type system analyst, and later became like a support services manager for Queensland, I suppose you'd say. I had to look after property, I had to look after IT, office services, all those odds and ends sort of things. And that's what. And eventually, Veterans Affairs was shrinking its organisation in keeping with the dying off of the old World War II veterans, and they decided they would outsource their IT function. So I was made an offer too good to refuse by IBM to come and head it up in Brisbane,
right.
That part of it. And that's what I did. I worked for them for a couple of years before I retired.
Okay.
The excitement of the early days at Tidbinbilla is just something that never can be matched. It's the sort of thing that everybody is allowed to have one brilliant period in their working life, and that was mine.
Pioneering, wasn't it?
It was.
This interview with Bruce Window was recorded for honeysucklecreek.net by Colin McKellar in March 2010.